since I'm here to talk about the law regarding abortion, particularly in California, although we are going to stray outside California, I did want to establish one vocabulary term right up front, because I realize sometimes I can talk too fast and it could be a little confusing, since the law of abortion involves a lot of court cases. When I refer, you know, most courts are made up of an uneven number of judges to make sure that there's not a direct split in an opinion. And so the majority of judges is known as the majority opinion. And then those who are not in the majority, and if they write an opinion, that's called the dissent. And so I just want to make sure it's the majority and the dissent are the two sides of any appellate court opinion. In California, abortion was illegal from almost the beginning of when California became a state, not quite at the beginning, but in the 1860s, I believe, is when they first passed a law against abortion, making abortion illegal in all cases except when necessary to preserve the life of the mother. That law existed for 100 years and was applied and was enforced. And it was struck down kind of unusual way, which it was after the law had actually been superseded by a statute liberalizing California's abortion law passed in 1967. But it's still worthwhile. So what happened was there was a doctor who had been charged under the old law, and he appealed his conviction, and that went up to the California Supreme Court. So even after the law had been liberalized by the California Therapeutic Abortion Act, which I'll be discussing, the opinion which reversed his conviction is still worth considering and looking at, because it set it sort of put into place various of the terms and that shows what the thinking was around the late 60s around abortion law. And you know how the courts were a tool in liberalizing abortion law, even at the same time statutory law was changing. So there was an opinion called People versus Belus, and it struck down that law prohibiting abortion except when necessary to preserve the life of the mother, claiming that term, that exemption, was too vague to be. It made the law uncertain and therefore was a denial of due process because it was too vague to be enforced. And though the court also started to use the term privacy as a reason why this area of the law has to be particularly careful and cautious because privacy interests are at stake, they started pushing the idea that the original abortion laws were passed not to protect the unborn, but to preserve the life of the mother. Preserve the health and safety of women, that there was a pretense that abortion laws were not actually about protecting the unborn, which was false. It also then moved from, since abortion laws to protect the health and safety of women, well, now that was 100 years ago, and now abortion is much safer than it was 100 years ago. And so that whole calculus of which is safer, abortion or childbirth, has changed. It also fed into the idea that abortion is purely a medical decision and that belongs in the hands of doctors, pushed a moral equivalency between abortion and childbirth. You know, they're both are just outcomes of pregnancy and there's no real distinction between them. And already doctors were using any sort of vagueness in a law as a way to get around the law, especially when it came to exceptions. And already judges were engaging in deception and distraction in all these matters. These are all things that, as you will see, just that kept going and going and going for decades in terms of how courts were treating abortion. But I think it's also interesting to see what the dissent in that case had to say about the majority's decision that the California abortion law had been unconstitutional all along. It said, the law historically, in various contexts, has regarded the unborn child as a human being. And it quoted a standard legal textbook from the time saying, medical authority has recognized long since that the child in existence is in existence from the moment of conception. and for many purposes, its existence is recognized by the law. The criminal law regards it as a separate entity, and the law of property considers it in being for all purposes which are to its benefit. All writers who have discussed the problem have joined in maintaining that the unborn child in the path of an automobile is as much a person in the street as the mother. So this is, again, this was written in 1969. And so back then, the court, I mean, a dissent could quote authorities saying the unborn child is a human being, is a person for all purposes in the law. And another judge in the dissent really called out the majority for its deceptiveness. And it said, especially about claiming that these words in the statute, which have been applied for 100 years, were somehow vague and now all of a sudden incomprehensible. That dissent said, the gist of this is that the three words, quote, necessary to preserve, end quote, are so shrouded in darkness that the average man cannot detect what they mean. Although average men and women and all average men and men above average have had no trouble with them for 100 years. I cannot accept so tortured a conclusion wrenched from a statute which has had its roots in the law's historic solicitude for the priceless gift of life. Again, this is showing that it was well understood that the abortion laws were to protect the life of the unborn, were not simply concerned with the health of the mother. Then California in 1967 did pass the California Therapeutic Abortion Act, making its laws about abortion among the most liberal in the country at that time. It allowed abortion, but even then, this is what passed for a liberal abortion law in 1967. It allowed abortion up to 20 weeks, in an accredited hospital, only after approval by a hospital committee, and only for the reasons of rape, incest, or the physical or mental health of the mother. And that sounds like a pretty restrictive law, but these exceptions very soon swallowed the rule. Abortions were quite easily obtained. In fact, the hospital committees approved virtually all applications for abortions, and the vast majority, over 95%, in fact, 98.2% were done for reasons of mental health. So it goes to show that, unfortunately, exceptions to abortions laws are soon become gaping loopholes. And this was effectively acknowledged by the California Supreme Court in 1972, when it struck down that restriction on the reasons women could get abortions. And again, it reached for that vagueness argument. So, well, this is vague. How can a doctor understand what it means to protect the life or health of the mother? And so it struck down that limitation on when abortions, on the reasons for abortions. But again, indulging in deception, because in this case, the deception was that the person, doctors never had to decide whether an abortion met these criteria. It was only it was up to the hospital committee to decide that. And so a doctor would not have any doubt. Either the hospital committee approved it or the hospital committee did not approve it. So the doctor was never in any danger of sort of stumbling into a violation of the law, which is the basis for striking down laws on vagueness grounds, is people of ordinary understanding should know when they're violating the law. Well, in the doctor's case, it was simply, did the hospital committee approve this abortion or not? So it was a case, again, of really a court engaging in deception to reach a predetermined end. And so in that case, they got rid of that restriction, but the case came down only 2 months before Roe versus Wade. And Roe versus Wade invalidated all the abortion laws across the country, including California's. And so there was never really a substantial period of time in which that California law was operating in that fashion, with the hospital committees and the approval by the hospital, but no more, and up to 20 weeks, that decision probably hadn't even been had time to take effect before Roe versus Wade was handed down. The next significant thing that happened in California history was that in 1972, the voters approved an amendment to the state constitution, adding the word privacy to the list of inalienable rights in the California constitution. And individuals' inalienable rights, they had a list of speech and religion and things like, and then they added privacy. And at the time that was understood and it was sold to the voters as being a, for the purpose of protecting informational privacy. The argument was big corporations and government can collect your data. And so we need to have a right to privacy. And California voters approved that. But then in 1980, the California legislature, actually would have been a few years before 1980, the California legislature passed a funding restriction saying that they would not include funding for abortions in California's Medi-Cal program. And funding restrictions had already been approved by the Supreme Court. They had passed muster with the Supreme Court, the same Supreme Court that handed down the Roe versus Wade decision invalidating almost all abortion restrictions, nonetheless upheld restrictions that said that the Hyde Amendment, for instance, and then state Medicaid restrictions that excluded abortion, those were consistent with Roe and were therefore constitutional. And so a California organization called the Committee to Defend Reproductive Rights made the argument in state court that that word privacy in the California Constitution meant that California had an independent constitutional right for abortion right in the Constitution. So we were not reliant on the federal Constitution and for rights to abortion. Now there was a right to abortion in the state constitution, except it was called a right to privacy. And the California Supreme Court agreed and ruled that the state could not exclude abortions from its state funding. And it did, again, relying on that sort of moral equivalency and medical equivalency between abortion and childbirth. Oh, these are both just two outcomes of pregnancy. But then also with that gloss of a constitutional right, which meant that if you, by excluding abortions from coverage, they were in effect punishing people for exercising their constitutional right to have an abortion. And so they turned it into an equal protection argument, which is somehow, you know, by excluding a procedure, they were punishing people. And that was the first time that case established that California's right to abortion in its own constitution is broader than the federal constitutional right. And that happened again a few years later when the state legislature passed laws mandating that a minor have to get her parental consent before having an abortion. And the United States Supreme Court had said such laws were constitutional, were consistent with Roe. There was nothing wrong with those laws. And yet the California Supreme Court said, well, our state constitutional right to privacy is more stringent, is broader than the federal right. And therefore under the state constitution, no, you cannot impose a parental consent or parental notification requirement. And in terms of, once again, going back to the theme of judicial dishonesty, the decision first came down 4-3 in favor of upholding the law. And then the decision came down right at the end of the judicial term in 1996, just as one justice was stepping down, retiring, and the challenge AAP, which was challenging the law, filed a petition for rehearing. And by the time the petition for rehearing was heard, that justice had been replaced by a different justice and who voted to rehear the case. And then when the case was reheard, voted to strike down the law. And so what had been a 4-3 decision in favor of upholding the law became a 4-3 decision in favor of striking it down. The next chapter in California's abortion history was the 2002 California Reproductive Privacy Act, in which the gloves came off. California, the legislature simply declared that every woman has the fundamental right to choose to bear a child or to choose and to obtain an abortion, except as specifically limited by this article. And the limitations, as you can imagine, are extremely small. It has to be done, the abortion has to be done by a doctor, or at that time it was a doctor, that's changed as well, but only by persons authorized under statute to do abortions. And if it was post viability, then it would be illegal if in the good faith medical judgment of the physician, continuation of the pregnancy pose no risk to the life or health of the pregnant woman. So they sort of flipped that. Instead of saying you can't do an abortion unless there's a danger to the life or health of the mother, they basically said you can do an abortion unless you find that it affirmatively doesn't pose a health risk. So a doctor who simply doesn't look, who doesn't do any examination, since he hasn't affirmatively found that there's no risk, there's nothing illegal about that abortion. And again, that only applied to post-viability pregnancies. And as far as viability itself, the viability is a concept that was created in Roe as creating a sort of a dividing line in abortions. I'm going to cover that later. As I keep going through California law, just the continuing liberalization of California's abortion law. Initially, there were regulations that governed abortion clinics. And among those regulations was a very weak sort of informed consent provision about telling a woman, about the benefits and burdens and dangers and things like that. Nothing like a fetal development or anything like that, but there was a form of informed consent there, along with other clinic regulations. However, a few years ago, there was a revamping of the regulatory code and all those provisions disappeared. So now there are there's no statute, there's no regulatory control, special provisions for abortion clinics. In 2017, the legislature legalized abortions by non-physicians. UCSF basically designed a study specifically to back up that legislation, specifically to prove that properly trained non-physicians could do abortions just as safely as physicians. And although, in fact, they claimed that to the legislature, if you look at the study, it showed that non-physicians had twice the complication rate as physicians. But no one really cared. The law was a done deal. And then also, the interesting thing is, as part of the study, the doctors would screen out patients. Before you participate in the study, there would be doctors screening out patients who presented particularly complicated, whose pregnancies were complicated one way or another. And so you have to wonder, okay, what happens to the safety factor then when there is no doctor who's screening out the particularly complicated patients? In any event, now with the abortion pill, RU486, mifepristone, almost half of abortions are done with that these days. So the idea of who's doing the early surgical abortions is almost mooted that issue. More recently, the legislature, always searching for more ways to expand abortion, they passed a law requiring that the abortion pill be available on college campuses, on all UC and CSU campuses, starting in, and now I can't remember if it's this January or next January, provided that the program is supposed to secure its own private funding. And I have to admit, I'm not sure. I don't know if anybody will know if they have or not until that date comes when those clinics are, or those, that availability is supposed to start. They also had on their, they were considering a law to make abortion absolutely positively free for everyone, which meant that they were going to mandate that insurance companies not be able to charge any deductibles or co-pays or make any costs at all for abortions. And that law was sailing through the legislature this summer. And then, it stalled and it was withdrawn. And I don't know why, but I do know that we let the legislature know that this law directly contradicted that abortion funding case that I was talking about earlier, which said you have to treat abortion and childbirth neutrally. According to that principle, you could not say we're going to make abortions, we're going to force insurance companies to make abortions absolutely free without doing the same for childbirth. So it could be that having pointed out that issue to them, they decided to take that one back to the drawing board and see how they could fix it. As far as moving in a pro-life direction, that's impossible in the California legislature at this point. And so the only way to do that is ballot initiatives. And as was mentioned in my introduction, I worked on ballot initiatives to try to create a law that would require parental notification before an abortion. And in those, it was interesting to see, we did three of them. We did not, none of them managed to qualify three for the ballot, which involves a massive number of signatures in California and is pretty expensive undertaking. And we did qualify it three times. It came within, I think the closest was less than 4%, you know, 51 point something to 48 point something. And it was frustrating that we could not do that. But what we saw was you could see the three big lies about parental notification. One of them is that most girls tell their parents, and that is based on a study that was done in the 1980s at a clinic in, I think it was Wisconsin or Minnesota. And what the study showed was that 60% of girls reported that a parent knew that they were getting abortion. And so that is not the same as telling a parent. It's not the same. And not only that, the times have changed since then in terms of, there were no cell phones then, there was no internet then, there was no Uber or Lyft then. The fact that in 1980s, girls could not get an abortion without their parent finding out is a completely different world now in terms of what minors might be able to do in terms of getting an abortion without a parent knowing. And the other tagline they had was, if she can't come to me, I just want her to be safe. So they had these ads featuring women, suburban mom types saying, if she can't come to me, I just want her to be safe. And so when we, in our second initiative, we said, okay, we'll take you up on that. We will make this, you will be able to do a preemptive permission slip. All you soccer moms who feel that way, you can sign something ahead of time. And you sign something ahead of time, giving permission to your daughter to get an abortion without your knowing about it. They were not very pleased with that, but they did have to change their strategy to being one, I'm not the problem, it's the other mother who's the problem. They had to change their marketing for the second one. But I think the most, the idea is that the minors are going to, they will go out and get unsafe abortions, or they will be beaten by their parents or thrown out of their house or things like that. And we put, for those of you who are not from California, in California, you have a ballot pamphlet for these initiatives. You get a big booklet in the mail, which has what the upcoming propositions are, and you have pro and con arguments. And there's ability, the way that works, for those of you who probably don't know this, is you each, the proponents and the main opponents, submit their arguments. And if either side thinks the other side is being deceptive or saying things aren't true, there's an opportunity to take that to court. And the other side kept saying, oh, you know, girls, you know, studies show that, you know, girls won't tell their parents they'll go get illegal abortions, and studies show that this and that. But they couldn't come up with any particular instances of anything having happened with a parental consent or parental notification law, despite the fact that these laws are in effect in 35 other states. And so when we finally did, when we did our last initiative, we kind of kept upping our language as we went along in the ballot pamphlet thing. And they would, one time they challenged it and we were able to beat back the challenge saying, you know, there's no proof of harm. And so in our last one, and I just think this is worth bringing up, we put in the ballot pamphlet that we threw down the gauntlet. We said, notification laws are protecting girls in over 30 states and have been for up to 25 years. Read the opposing argument carefully. Notice it says may and if. There are no real stories, not a single example of a real teenager harmed by a notification law. That's because it has never happened. Out of millions of girls, the opposition couldn't find one real girl harmed by a notification law. Now, all that they would have had to do is find one real girl, and they would have brought that action in court, which they had done before, and made it, and we would have had to change the language. They didn't even try. They could not find any case where these notification laws had harmed. But I think that's important, not just for the notification thing, but to show that how Planned Parenthood and pro-abortion advocates scare people with what might happen, what could happen, and studies show that this, you know, they kind of cobble together studies to show that a result that in fact never has happened, but boy, it's likely to happen. And another feature of our initiatives was that we had them had only civil penalties, meaning we wanted to avoid pictures of doctors behind bars and things like that. So we said, no, the law will only be enforced by if a parent wants to sue the doctor, civil penalty. And we also did that because that's a harder law to challenge. And if that sounds familiar to you, it means you've been paying attention to what's been going on in Texas, because that is exactly the why the Texas heartbeat bill is still working right now. In Texas, they passed a law requiring doctors to first do a sonogram to detect if there was a heartbeat. And if there was a heartbeat, they could not do an abortion. And that law has only civil penalties. It only allows, it does kind of do something. It allows anybody to bring a lawsuit against the doctor for doing that abortion. And it's tied up the legal system because there's no one to sue. It's not the state who's enforcing the law. So there is no one to sue to say, don't do this, don't sue me, don't, you know. And so it's just the way it's supposed to operate is you just have to sit back. If you think you're right about this law, that this law is unconstitutional, just sit back and wait to be sued, and then you can raise your defense then. And so at this point, for those who haven't, the Supreme Court first refused to step in and stop it based on a very esoteric procedure, and so it went into effect, and then the United States government sued to stop it, and a federal judge in Texas did enjoin it, but that was reversed 2 days later, at least temporarily, by the Fifth Circuit. And as of now, that law is still in effect. Now you say, well, what does it mean to be in effect? Well, it means right now that there are a lot of abortionists who are too scared to do abortions in Texas, and at least after 6 weeks, after a heartbeat is detected. And so it's, I, a lot of lawyers along with me are watching that with great interest. Meanwhile, the other very interesting development right now in abortion law sort of nationwide is that there is a, for the first time in 30 years, possibly more, there is a case up before the United States Supreme Court challenging Roe versus Wade and saying that Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided. You often hear, you know, you hear Roe and Casey is because Roe versus Wade decided in 1973 was the first, you know, law established a right to abortion. And then Casey, 19 years later, reaffirmed that. It was thought that that we all hoped at that time that would be the case that overturned Roe. Instead, it reaffirmed Roe and just sort of took it down a notch in terms of what other, what regulations and restrictions could be put on abortion. But in doing so, created a great confusion in the lower courts as to what's permissible and what's not permissible. And, but that's why there was many years spent working, you know, partial birth abortion ban or a pain capable ban or various forms of parental involvement. And now there's prenatal non-discrimination laws saying you can't have abortion for reasons of Down syndrome and things like that, all sorts of variations. And the structure set up by the Supreme Court to decide these cases is just producing mass confusion in the lower courts. But I did want to point out one other thing about Roe. I realize that probably this audience is very familiar with it, but what you might not know, if you recall at the beginning, I talked about how the California court was trying to make this just a medical issue. It's just a medical decision, but and that decision predated Roe, but that's exactly what happened in Roe. It starts out. There is a line in Roe that talks about the right to privacy being broad enough to encompass a woman's decision to end her pregnancy. But by far, the most frequent references in Roe are to the decision a woman and her doctor will make together. In fact, as the decision progresses, there is more references to the doctor than there is to the woman. For instance, it says, when talking about pre-viability, it says, for the period of pregnancy prior to this compelling point, the attending physician, in consultation with his patient, is free to determine, without regulation by the state, that in his medical judgment, the patient's pregnancy should be terminated. And then a little later it says, for the stage prior to approximately the end of the first trimester, the abortion decision and its effectuation must be left to the medical judgment of the pregnant woman's attending physician. They had completely turned, as if this, you know, that the only reason a woman would have an abortion would be for medical reasons, and we can't have the state interfering in that. 19 years later, in the Casey decision, I don't know that there was any reference to the doctor that was probably not just a quote from Roe, because by then, 19 years into abortion on demand, it was clearly understood that abortion was a social decision and not a medical decision. And abortion is, you know, treated as a constitutional right because of the social implications, not because of the medical implications. But feminists do find it always convenient to be able to go back to calling it healthcare and referring to women's medical needs. So anyway, this Supreme Court case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which is, that's the only abortion clinic in Mississippi this time, the court now has squarely before it the question of whether Roe and Casey should be overturned. And I did provide the organizers here with a couple of readings relevant to that. One is going to what the possibilities are for what this court decision will be, because everybody wants to know, what do you think the court's gonna do? One thing it could do is outright reverse Roe and Casey. And I have attached, one of the readings is one of my favorite amicus briefs written by the attorney who actually authored the Texas law, and just a brilliant takedown of Roe versus Wade. another thing the court could do is like search for some sort of middle ground. But the difficulty with doing that is set forth in a second reading I provided called No Whittling Away at Roe, because there is no basis for finding Roe is so illegitimate anyway. Then to try to cut it back and say, well, it would just increase the problems, as they did in Casey, which is like you just get slipperier and slipperier. What are the rules that we're dealing with here? Because none of it's found in the Constitution. The third thing they might do is find a way to simply avoid the question. I mentioned that Jackson Women's Health Organization, the clinic that is bringing this challenge, is the only abortion clinic in Mississippi. It does abortions up to 16 weeks. The law at issue is a ban on abortions after 15 weeks. I'm really worried about this. That maybe Jackson Women's Health Organization will just say, okay, you know, if we have a bad oral argument, we'll just say we won't do abortions after 15 weeks, and we'll dismiss our challenge, and then it'll just take the case away from the Supreme Court. The court could try to find, again, they could try to find some way just to, I think everybody thinks they are going to uphold this 15-week ban. They are not going to strike it down. But the question is, how would they justify doing that, since Roe and Casey are premised on viability being a dividing line? And so to set any other line or any, it just doesn't make sense. This law is not consistent with Roe and Casey. So to uphold it and not strike down Roe and Casey, it's just very difficult to see how they could do that. And I guess there is always the possibility that they could in fact strike down the law. I mean, I have to say that's in there, but I don't think anybody thinks that's gonna happen. The effect in California will be virtually, non-existent in terms of California's laws, other than that I think if they did strike down Roe and Casey, and if there were restrictions put on abortion in states like Arizona, I don't know about Nevada, if they might restrict, maybe more gestational limits on how late an abortion could be done. We might be seeing more women coming from out of state to California, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if the legislature says we'll pay for those abortions as well. We'll help those women get transportation. California is just a really pro-abortion state legislature.